Well,
I have no clue.
You have no clue. Well, it's actually, this is my first time here with the time change, and it's really a beautiful view that you guys have. I can see why it's nice to have the lights a little, things a little darker, so you don't have to look at me. You can kind of look out here, because there's more beauty out there, believe me. Yeah, what a crazy week for everyone, huh? I will, maybe when there's a sharing time, we'd love to share some ways that you can pray for our family, but it has been kind of a wild and crazy week for us as well. And I think it's only fitting that God has given us a great passage here in Psalm 40 to kind of hear David's perspective about God and about life. Janet and I were watching a movie the other night, and it's kind of interesting. I don't know what watching movies like is at your home. We used to fight over what to get at the video store. Remember when you had to go to the video store? So I'd be kind of like, hey, what do you want to watch? I don't know, what do you want to watch? And me being OCD, I'd kind of go through every video in the whole store. I'd start with the new releases and then go to the old comedies and then the westerns and then the, didn't really get to the foreign film stuff, you know. And I'd take like an hour and a half. I still hadn't found anything. Or I'd come up with four things. And she's like, just make a choice, you know. And then Janet would go in and get one and she'd be like out in like 3 minutes. I'm like going, honey, what are we watching? The Beaver, Nature's Architect. Really? This is what we're watching. She's like, I just want to be with you. Okay. All right, I get that. So fast forward, we do the same thing on Netflix. And so I finally find, let's watch something on Netflix. And within 5 minutes, she's asleep. So one of the movies that we watched recently that she was able to stay up for long enough was Hacksaw Ridge. Did anybody see this one? Quite an amazing story, but also just a powerful story about a young man named Desmond Doss, who was a Seventh-day Adventist. And wanted to fight for his country because all the men in his town were signing up and enlisting, and that's what men did a long time ago, is they wanted to defend their country. But as a Seventh-day Adventist, and with some of the things that had happened in his own home, he refused to carry a gun because he did not think that God wanted him to carry a gun. Killing was wrong, and when you understood his home life, he really had an extra sense of conviction about that. Well, the commanding officers didn't really like that idea. And what ensued was the fact that he was just getting mistreated over and over again because they're afraid he would not be a good example of an infantryman, of U.S. Army men. That if you're not going to hold your rifle, if you're not going to learn how to use your rifle, you're not only going to be a bad example to them, you might not be able to rescue them when they needed your help. There are Christians who are critical of him because as a Seventh-day Adventist, he would have to take his day of Sabbath, Saturday, seriously. And a lot of Christians didn't agree with that. And the idea that some Christians were also trying to convince him that it's okay to fight the enemy if they're really the enemy and you can kill the bad guys. God's okay about killing the bad guys. So people were wondering what kind of example this guy was going to actually be if he's out there on the battlefield, both as an infantryman and as a Christian. And as the movie unfolds, you start to realize that this man had remarkable character. That even though he never carried a weapon, didn't give you the better part of the story here. He wanted to be a medic. That's why he didn't carry a weapon. You're probably thinking, wait a minute, how does that work to go into war without a weapon? He wanted to be a medic. He wanted to go out and save lives and help lives instead of destroy lives. So as he was doing his duty as a medic, and I won't get into all the details of the movie, but the way it turns out, it was just this incredibly precarious situation that he found himself in the Asian theater. And what happened was little by little, because of his tenacity, and I think because of his faith, he was able to save man after man after man on this battlefield that was this incredible carnage everywhere. I used to have these really weird, silly daydreams about being old enough to fight in World War II, and I left those behind because there's nothing romantic about that. It's just nothing but raw courage, raw bravery, and just a lot of ugly things that happened. Because of his work, he was able to save 77 men from this battlefield. And when the story's finished, you realize that this man was not only a great example of an army man in the sense of how he cared for his fellow soldiers, he's also a great example of his faith. That he believed with conviction about who God was and how God wanted him to live his life. And he lived that brilliantly. And what's interesting about our psalm today is I think this is an example. We're going to look at David's experience about how God met him, how God needed to continue to meet him. And I think what we're going to see is, at least for me, an example of somebody of what does it really look like to walk with God? How do we see him? How do we talk to him? How do we see our world, our life, our troubles, our trials? and see God in all that. And that's what I hope that we'll find as we look at the life of David in Psalm 40 as we unpack this together. And you know, it's interesting because we need that, don't we? Not only just in regular life, but the crazy that's going on right now, a lot of the fears, a lot of the unknown, a lot of the family that we have that are in situations. Our daughter is flying home right now. Her program was called short, and we wanted her to land in Portland, and she's going to land in Seattle. And she's got to wait there, and then she's got to fly down. We've got a lot of other moving parts. And like you, you've got moving parts, and it's scary in some ways. Not necessarily crazy scary, but just the unknown of what's going to happen with the hysteria around us. And so we can find some comfort in walking with God as we look at how David walked with God as well. What's interesting about Psalm 40 is that as we take a look at it, it contains a passage, a messianic passage. And we look at Hebrews chapter 10. The author of Hebrews refers back to this psalm. So what's interesting about the psalm itself is some have suggested that this entire psalm is messianic. That if you were to look at it from verse 1 to verse 17, you can see the life of Christ in his ministry at every verse. Some would say, no, it's a veiled reference in the sense that the author of Hebrews is appropriating some of what's being said, but it's not necessarily a prophecy. Some would communicate that it's just David's life. That's all this is going on here. And some would suggest that it's actually a little bit of both. That like God does in other places in scriptures, he uses the words of people in the present moment and actually is speaking through them about some future fulfillment. And that's how I would take our passage today, Psalm 40. That we're looking at the life of David. But David's going to say some things that have this future echo into the life of the Messiah that I want us to kind of take a brief moment on. But as we jump into Psalm 40, I'm reminded of what the author of Hebrews says in 13:7 of the book of Hebrews. He says, "Remember those who led you, who spoke the word of God to you, and considering the result of their conduct, imitate their faith." And that's what I hope. I hope that as we get done looking at the life of David in Psalm 40, there'll be something in this for all of us to say, man, I want to be a little bit more like that guy. I want to follow God a little bit more like the way David does. I think a way to summarize this entire psalm is this idea that God saw, David is looking at God and he's saying, God, because you have helped me before, I will ask you to help me again. It's almost like a circle that we're going to get into as we look at what David's going through. But because he's seen God come through for him, it emboldens him to say, I know you can come through for me again. I know that can happen because what I've seen you do in my life. In the first 10 verses of Psalm 40, I think it really reflects David's past experience of God's relief. He's experienced God in the past, and it's a very powerful experience that I want us to unpack. But the second half of Psalm 40 reflects his present need for God's relief. So let's jump in. And what I'm going to do is I want to kind of just read through as we go instead of reading it all the way through and then coming back. But in verse 1, what we see in this first section of David's experience of God's relief, the very first thing we see in verse 1 is David's posture. As we start this psalm, where is David at? And what's interesting about this psalm is it seems to me as I've read through this, it's almost like we're going to go on this emotional roller coaster, much like adolescence with your children, you know? There's a lot of emotion that's going to be coursing through here. And as we start, we see that David is in this posture of waiting. He says, I waited patiently for the Lord. I don't know what gets conjured up in your heart when it comes to waiting, but waiting is not necessarily a pleasant thing for me. That unansweredness, that uneasiness of not knowing what's ahead, of wanting some closure. And David's in this spot of waiting for God and saying, what's going to happen here? He's here in this spot that's not always easy. We don't know how long God waited. We don't know, David waited for God to intervene. Apparently it wasn't instantaneous because he's still in this posture of waiting. And what's interesting, like I said, is this is, it's not a fun place to be. I can't think of anybody who loves to wait. Is there anyone here that just loves to wait? I hate waiting. I mean, have you been to Disneyland? I don't know if you've been to Disneyland in any recent amount of time. And you're on these rides and they're trying to be encouraging to you and help you understand how much longer you have to go till you actually get on the ride. And they have these signs that will give you like a little, hey, this is how far you have to wait still. You know, when you get to one that's like 3 days from here, you're like, I want to get off this ride. But I remember the first time we did that with the kids and we didn't have a fast pass. And I saw this 90 minutes from here. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. What do you mean 90 minutes from here? I don't have enough food to wait 90 minutes. I mean, I'm the guy at the grocery store, at Costco especially. Are you like this, that when you're in line and you kind of are counting back and you see another line that's maybe got one cart less than you? How many people are thinking about jumping lines right there? Aren't we all kind of thinking about jumping that? Because why? We don't want to wait that one more cart. And then what happens to you probably happens, or what happens to me probably happens to you. What happens when you change that line? The line you're in was faster, wasn't it? I hate it when that happens. And yet we start in this position of this psalm where David's just waiting, and we don't know how long he's waiting. But what we see is that God does come through for him. And what we begin to unpack is how he feels about the way God came through for him. And what's interesting about the word patiently, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's suffering long. It means that he's waiting intently. He's waiting with focus. He's waiting with an attitude of expectation that God is going to do something. Why? Because this is who God is. He's waiting expectantly. So what is God's response? Verses 2 and 3. And he inclined to me and heard my cry. He brought me up out of the pit of destruction, out of the miry clay. And he set my foot upon a rock, making my footsteps firm. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. And there's three ways that God helped David that he's identifying. First is God brought David out of this situation, this place. It's not clear what it is. Is it a physical thing primarily? Is it an emotional place primarily? It's not clear. We don't know. But what we know, it was not a good place for David to be. Think about the imagery that's here. He's in a pit. What's the pit about? It's about being destroyed in this pit. He's stuck in miry clay. Actually, the idea is it's like a muddy, miry pit that he's in. Now, is this a physical pit? Probably not. But it's this beautiful picture of what he feels like emotionally. He is stuck. He is afraid. And we don't know why he is, but he's saying, I'm stuck and I'm afraid. And you know what God did? He took him out of this place. He took him out of this situation. And he not only took him out, secondly, he put him in a better place. He says, I'm not just going to take it away and you're still on the kind of the precipice of maybe slipping back into it. I'm taking you out of this thing and I'm putting you on this place that is firm, that is stable, that will give you relief to the stress that you're under. When I was a kid, the only way to get into our attic was by this ladder. We didn't have one of the ladder things that came down when you opened the door, so we had to get the ladder. Ours was in a carport. We didn't have a garage, like an enclosed garage. It was just a carport. So we had to get the ladder up. And I know sometimes it was kind of, hey, get the Christmas decorations down. But I remember when I was like in third or fourth grade, and I'm like this tall, and I'm trying to get the ladder set up, and go into the attic. So you have to move the little thing out of the way. Now, I had to stand on the top of this ladder and grab this thing and jump from the ladder to hoist myself into this thing. So once I'm in, I'm fine, right? It's getting down that's a little tricky. And so as I'm trying to get this thing down, I'm putting myself through this hole, I'm dangling my legs, and I'm trying to find the ladder. And it's in that moment that it feels really, really scary because you don't know how you're going to land. And even when I start to feel that top of the ladder, I don't know if I got it just right. But once I was down firmly on that ladder, there's an incredible amount of relief that comes. It says, I'm safe. And David's moved from this spot of waiting to feeling stuck to now he's feeling safe. And now he not only feels so safe, the third thing that he sees God do is God puts a new song in his heart. That God actually gives him joy from this relief. He actually inspires him to write a song about this experience, to celebrate what God has done for him. And it's a song about God, praising him. What's interesting is that now, because of what he's experienced from God, he's now in a position to see God, experience God, and talk about God in a totally different way because of what God has done for him and how he's taken care of him. But it's interesting that his song is not simply a response about, gee, thanks for what happened in this specific moment. This song is actually something God's going to use. God has a larger purpose for what David went through. God has a larger purpose for how he answered David's prayer. He says at the end of verse 3 and verse 4, many will see and fear and will trust in the Lord. How blessed is the man who has made the Lord his trust and has not turned or regarded the proud, nor turned to those who lapse in the falsehood. There's almost like two things that David sees at his experience from God. First of all, it's almost like an evangelistic tool. He says, God, people are going to see what you did for me. They're going to see how you answered my prayer. They're going to see how I responded in this. And you know what? Many people are going to see that you're more real because of what you've done to me. They will see you. They will fear you. They will trust you because of what you've done, how real you are in my life. And David, in a sense, the second thing he sees is there's a principle of life here. That as David is kind of assessing all that God's done for him, he says, you know what I'm going to take away from this right now? I'm going to take away this very simple principle. How blessed is the man who's made the Lord his trust and not turned to the proud, nor turned to those who lapse into falsehood. He's like, I got this lesson. Not only did God save me from this, I've got this life principle now that my life is better. My life is blessed. My life is happiest. The idea behind the term blessed here is happy. My life is best. When? When I'm trusting in God. You see, he's not just seeing this as a simple answer to prayer. It's like, wow, there's something bigger going on here. This is causing me to find that God is trustworthy. And the more that I begin to believe that he's trustworthy, the more I'm going to feel blessed. The more I'm going to be happy because I see it in the right perspective. And I love the contrast that he gives here. He said, the person who trusts in God, not in what? Not in the proud. The proud is the opposite of humble, right? So proud people aren't humble. They're like, you don't need God. You can do this all by yourself. That's hocus pocus. They're proud. He doesn't turn to those people to kind of get perspective. He doesn't turn to the other people. The idea that they lapse into falsehood. In other words, what's the opposite of falsehood? It's truth. In other words, they're away from truth. They're people who tell lies. They're people who come to him when he's suffering and says, you know what? God doesn't care about you. God's not going to take care of you. He doesn't mean those things. He says, I'm not going to turn to those people to give me counsel. Why? Because they're proud. Because they're liars. I'm not going to find any comfort in that. Where I'm going to find comfort and blessing and happiness is by trusting that God is going to take care of me and that I've seen him take care of me. You know, what's been interesting of late, and I'm willing to bet that not a single person in this room has ever seen Good Mythical Morning. Has anyone seen Good Mythical Morning? There we go. That kind of fits the demographic I'm looking for. Good Mythical Morning is a YouTube show by two guys, Rhett and Link, and they've been on for about, I don't know, 7, 8 years, or has it been longer than that? I can't remember. Yeah. But anyways, these guys are funny. They're really funny. And they have a really interesting show, and they do all kinds of crazy stuff, and they have close to 17 million followers now. And what was interesting is that these guys were raised in Christian homes. They were involved in college in ministry. They came to work for our organization, Campus Crusade for Christ, were on staff for a couple of years, but realized that they have some comedy and some interest to get out and entertain, and so they moved to Hollywood to start a YouTube channel. And after several years or many years of doing this, like I said, they've got 17 million followers. They've been on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon. They've been kind of like his spot reporters, The Today Show, some other shows. They're really growing in their fame. It's estimated they're worth about $23 million, and estimated that because of their YouTube audience, they make about between $4 and $5 million a year because of the views. Now, these guys, coming from a Christian background, serving with the Christian ministry, had never said anything about their Christian faith during this program. But the only time they decided to talk about their Christian faith is when they deconstructed, where they left their faith behind. And so they both spent 90 minutes sharing their story of how they lost their faith and why they lost their faith. And now 17 million young people, because it's mostly adolescents who love the show, not to say that you're an adolescent, you learned it. Okay, you know what I'm talking about here. A lot of the followers are adolescents. And you know what they're hearing? Is they're hearing lies. And they're hearing pride. And they're learning that God's not trustworthy because of what these guys are saying. And David's experience is like, no, no, no. I've seen him work in my life. I've seen him show up. He is trustworthy. And the person who trusts in him is going to be successful and happy and live a life that's oriented in the right direction. And David just takes this even further, because now he has this even clearer picture. It's like his mind is growing in a sense, or his awareness is growing in the sense of how he's seeing God. The more he reflects on his experience, he now has a clearer picture of God from this. Look at verses 5 and 6. He says, "Many, O Lord my God, are the wonders which you have done, and your thoughts towards us. There is none to compare with you. If I would declare and speak of them, they would be too numerous to count. Sacrifice and meal offering you have not desired. My ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you have required. Have not required. And what's interesting is, again, David is saying that God's not only trustworthy, but why is he trustworthy? And there's two ideas he floats right here. First of all, is that God's incomparable. You just can't find anybody like him. You can't find any substitute that makes life make sense, that gives a sense of perspective, the sense of power, the sense of meaning, the sense of purpose. You can't find that. This God is incomparable, like we sang tonight. And there's two ideas that suggest that he's incomparable. He says, first of all, is that his wonders are numerous. The whole earth is filled with your glory. Isn't that what we say? And yet David's saying, as I'm becoming more and more aware of who God is and how real he is everywhere. His fingerprints are everywhere. Did anybody see the new moon that was kind of out the last 10 days? I think it was the new moon, right? I remember hearing about it on the news in the weather. And it's like the new moon. Okay, I'm quarter moon, half moon, blue moon, harvest moon, orange moon, blood moon. What's the new moon? And it was interesting how they talked about it. It almost sounded like this marketing program for guys. Like, the new moon is 7% brighter and 15% larger. You know, it's like, wait a minute. The new moon, new and improved moon. But the idea was that because of where the moon is in the rotation and all the science stuff that I don't fully get, it's going to be bigger and brighter. And I was out on my morning walk, and I was like, holy smokes, this is gorgeous. The night before, Sydney and I were driving home for Costco, and the thing just set right in the air. And it's like, this is amazing. And he could just tick off all these things that say, God did that, God did that, God did that, God did that, God did that. And he can't stop counting. It's like David's awareness of God is growing and growing and growing because of how God answered his prayers, how he's becoming more aware of who God really is and what God really does. He says the same thing about the thoughts towards us. That's the second thing. Not only are these works numerous and wonderful, but he actually has thoughts towards me. He actually thinks about me. He actually cares about me. I'm not just somebody that, oh yeah, he's a kid of somebody. You know, I started it a long time ago, and yeah, there's people going to come along. He's like, no. This is David, and I know David. And I know David's struggles. I know David's trials. He has so many thoughts about David. David says the same thing in Psalm 139:17, how precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. So David is just seeing how incomparable God is, his numerous works, his numerous thoughts. And this is fueling and clearing up this picture. God has not only answered my prayers, but look at who this God is. And the second thing that he says is really interesting, and I would just kind of want to throw this out there, and this is where we're going to start shifting into some of the thoughts on some prophecy. But what's interesting is how he talks then about the sacrifices. The second thing, not only is that God is incomparable, this is what he's seeing, this picture he's getting, but the second part of this picture that he's getting about God is that God really wants to have a relationship with his creatures. Now, when you read verse 6, it was hard for me to read and understand, because he says, sacrifice and meal offering you have not desired, my ears you have opened, burnt offering and sin offering you have not required. I'm reading through the Old Testament right now with some guys from my church, and what David just said is not really true. Because you start reading through the Old Testament, and God takes burnt offerings very seriously. Very seriously. Matter of fact, and as God was commanding the Israelites to teach their children about following God, it says, the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always and for our survival as it is today. So when I'm reading this, it's like, wait a minute, David, I think you got this wrong. Because sacrifices are really important to God. And then he says that his ears have been opened. I don't fully get that, but it seems like right in the middle of it, there's almost like this sense of like, I think I get a different perspective here. I think I'm hearing something different as I really ponder this. I think Janet loves this phrase here because she really wants my ears to be opened. Like, how many times did she say, did you hear me? Did you hear me? Did you hear me? So that's a totally different thing. I don't know. One of David's wives had that problem. But what's interesting is think about how Jesus said that what does God desire? Sacrifice or mercy? It's mercy, right? There's something behind the sacrifice that God's after. And what God's after is our loyalty. He's after our love. He's after our devotion. What God really wants for us is not to keep all the rules and cross all the I's and T's. That's involved. I get this. I'm trying to put the thing together. But what he's saying is that all of these sacrifices are for a larger, bigger purpose. And what that purpose is to know the God who created you. He wants us to do these things, not to do it in and of themselves. It's for the bigger purpose, to know him and to love him. And that's why I think he's saying this. That he's seeing a clearer picture of God. That he's not just a rule keeper. If you wanted to take that angle, he's not. He says, do these things so that we can have relationship. So you can know me and you can love me. That's the heart behind this. Well, as he has this clearer picture that's growing, David can't contain himself. He just keeps going through the psalm. And he bursts out in verses 7 through 10. Then I said, behold, I come, in the scroll of the book it is written of me. I delight to do your will, O God. Your law is within my heart. I proclaim glad tidings of righteousness in the great congregation. Behold, I will not restrain my lips, O Lord, you know. I have not hidden your righteousness within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your loving kindness or your truth from the great congregation. He's saying, I'm telling everybody how great you are. You're this amazing God. And he just lists all these things. Your faithfulness, your salvation, your loving kindness, which is this devotional love that God has towards us. He's like, I am seeing you so clearly, I want to tell everybody about it. I want everybody to know how great you are. Because what you have done for me, how you've answered my prayer, how you've rescued my soul, everybody needs to know you. Now, what's interesting about this passage, when you read it, you think, okay, behold, in verse 7, he says, behold, I come in the scroll of the book it is written of me. You're like, well, what book is he talking about? And if you think and do a little reading on it, you can't find it. Because there isn't a prophecy about David. So you wonder, well, if it's not talking about David, who is this talking about? And that's one of the ways that we understand prophecy, in the sense of, if it's not this immediate understanding, is there a different reference that's being made here? Is there somebody else that's being talked about here? That maybe in David's view, he wants to be somebody that God, that would be someone who does the law perfectly. Psalm 119 is all about his desire to do that. But this is a bigger statement than a desire. This is someone who's actually written about. This is someone who actually lives the law from his heart. So it can't really be David. This is where in the book of Hebrews chapter 10, what we find is that the author of the book of Hebrews is trying to make the argument to this Jewish community about why Christ is the Messiah. What is the role that Christ has done in his sacrifice for us and his role as high priest? And he quotes this passage. And he's basically saying that this idea that even though David sees behind these verses to see God wants relationship with us, what this is also referring to, the idea, is that the sacrificial system is more than the sacrificial system. It's pointing us towards something greater. And the author of Hebrews says this was never designed to be permanent. God's not saying, I want you to do sacrifices forever. It was never designed to be that way. It was designed to point us that we have a need that has to be met, that a sacrifice can't do it year after year after year. But what we need is someone who can fulfill that, who lives the law perfectly from their heart and fulfills the requirements of the law, but does away with that sacrificial system because it's not sufficient. And that person's going to have to give the one sacrifice that's the sacrifice of all sacrifices. So what he's saying in the book of Hebrews, that David is unaware as he's saying this, is that God is going to bring someone who fulfills the law, who perfectly fulfills the sacrifice, So that way the system can be done away, that God will no longer require this of us. Why? Because he's fulfilled it in his son. And even though David doesn't fully understand what he's saying, what's going on here is this bigger picture that God is using to say there is somebody who's going to come and take care of this in a much deeper and a much bigger way, David, than you understand. This relationship we're having, everyone's going to be able to have because of what he has done for us. So in these first 10 verses, what's interesting is David is spending all this time kind of reflecting on who God is. What has he done for me? How does that impact me? How do I view God? How do I feel about him? How do I talk about him? And I think as you look at these first 10 verses, there's two words that could summarize these 10 verses. And those two words are thank you. That David's saying, thank you. Thank you for what you've done. Thank you for how you've listened to me. Thank you for everything you've given me. Thank you for who you are. Thank you for your righteousness and all these things he talks about. Thank you. But what's interesting is now he's going to turn, because it's interesting as we go through this, he's been talking about you, and then he moves to I, and now he's back to saying, God, I need your help. He's talking about the present moment now, from verses 11 through 17. And I think what we could say about these next verses, the next section, this last part of the psalm, is that there's also two words that describe this section, and that's help me. Help me. David needs God's relief. And the first thing David does, in verse 11, is that for his present struggle is he rehearses what he knows to be true. Look at verse 11. You, O Lord, will not withhold your compassion from me. Your loving kindness and your truth will continually preserve me. See, to David, these weren't some dry theological doctrines about, you know, God's compassionate and God's loyal. He's like, no. This is who you are, and you are going to apply these to my life. There's this future tense. This is something you will do for me. He's not demanding it of God. He's believing it. He's rehearsing it. He's making it real in his heart that this is who you are, and this is how you're going to treat me. This is how you're going to take care of me. The reason that he rehearses these truths is because, once again, he's in dire straits. Look at verse 12. For evils beyond number have surrounded me. My iniquities have overtaken me, so that I am not able to see. They are more numerous than the hairs of my head, and my heart has failed me. This guy's in a really hurting spot. And think about this. Look at where we've come. Like, he's so excited, and God's finally come through him, and he's praising God and all these wonderful things about God, and now he's back in it again. He's stuck again. He's hurting again. And he's rehearsing, God, you're going to take care of me. And he lists three sources for this distress that he has. What are these three sources? First, he's surrounded by innumerable evils. You can't even count them. In verse 14, he talks about people who are seeking to destroy his life. Also in verse 14, people who delight in hurting him. Verse 15, people who mock him. And they mock him by saying things like, aha, aha. And the idea behind that phrase is it's people are getting satisfaction over the misfortune of their enemy. They're standing over him and saying, you're a loser. This guy's not coming through for you. What an idiot. You actually think this stuff? They're just mocking him. So he's got all this evil from outside of him that's pressing down on top of him. And at the same time, what's churling on the inside for him is his own sin that he says is innumerable, and he's overtaken by it. He's not just cognitively saying, yeah, I've sinned a couple times, I get that. It's like, no, the guilt, the shame has overtaken him. Isn't this the guy that's saying, hey, I'm going to proclaim your righteousness? You know, I'm going to live your law out from my heart. And what do we have in the next few phrases? I'm a sinner. And I'm not just a sinner, I'm a horrible sinner. I understand my sin. My sin grieves me. I feel guilty. I feel ashamed for what I've done. He says, I feel so bad about this, I can't even see. I don't think that means he can't see physically. He's like, I can't see the grace of God. I can't see God's forgiveness. I can't see his closeness. Why? Because I've been living my life all about me. I've been doing all my own stuff. I've been ignoring him. I've been caught up in my own sin and promoting myself. I can't even see him. And when I think about this relationship with him, when I think about my failures, my heart fails me. My own heart has forsaken me. And that's where you can almost hear this whisper of, and you call yourself a Christian. Really? This is where David is sitting. And it's a very acute place. It's a very desperate place. And yet, he's trying to hold on. It's so acute. This is why he says in verse 13, be pleased, O Lord, to deliver me. Make haste, O Lord, to help me. He's desperate. He's pleading. Deliver me, God. Help me. Hurry. He's in some serious pain. And this is such a contrast to where we started from. Well, as we move towards finishing, as David is processing his heart before the Lord, what's interesting is there's a crescendo of five different imperatives or commands or defiances that he lays out as he finishes what he's saying here in Psalm 40. The first three are angry and they're defiant towards his enemies. He says, let those be ashamed and humiliated together who seek my life to destroy it. Let those be turned back and dishonored who delight in my hurt. Let those be appalled because of their shame who say to me, aha, aha. He's like saying, God, let them have it. I am so angry for how they've been treating me. He's honest. He's real about the way he's been treated. And he wants justice. He's asking for justice. He's in the midst of being so hurt by what other people have done to him and so confused by his own sin, he's just saying, bring on the justice. Take care of these people that have hurt me. It's out of anger that he says these things. But it's almost like he's catching himself before he goes too long into the dark side, right? He's like, wait a minute, don't, if I just let into that anger, I'm going to become the wrong kind of person. And these last two imperatives are more an exhortation to others and himself to have perspective. He says, let all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. Let those who love your salvation say continually, the Lord be magnified. You see, David is reminding himself as he's sliding down this slope of anger and hatred towards people. He says, no, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Where does real rejoicing come from? Is it in other people's pain? Is it twisting the knife in somebody? Is that where gladness comes from? No. It comes in the Lord. It comes in my God. That's where I find rejoicing. That's where gladness is. And you know what I need to do? I need to make him bigger. I need to not focus on my circumstances. I need to focus on him. I need to magnify him. I need to make him bigger than my circumstances and this reality that's just crushing me, because that's where I'm going to find my hope and gladness. And he's just telling himself, hold on, get perspective, keep believing. Well, lastly, in conclusion of verse 17, he finishes with two vulnerable statements. He says simply, since I'm afflicted and needy. Look how honest he is. Look how vulnerable he is. It's almost like it's so simple, it's as if he's depleted, right? It's like, what else can I say? I'm needy. I'm afflicted. Then he offers two affirmations of belief. He's trying to hold on. He's saying, you are my help. You are my deliverer. He's reminding himself, stay in this thing. Hang on. God is your helper. He is your deliverer. And then he has two pleas that have a tint of doubt in them. He says, be mindful of me, O Lord, as if maybe God might not be. He says, don't delay, my God, as if maybe God might. But even as he's reminding himself, there's some doubt still in there. But he's saying, God, be mindful of me. Help me. Rescue me. And what's so amazing is we're right back to where we started, aren't we? Isn't this kind of where we started? And it's interesting. I don't know about your Christian life, but I don't like get answered prayer and stay up here forever, do you? We don't, do we? We do this a lot, don't we? We see God come through, and we get perspective, and we're excited, and we're boastful of how wonderful he is. And then we do something stupid. And then we sin. Or someone is mean to us. And we have to fight to hold on to believing who God is. And not listen to the proud. And not listen to the liars. And that's what David's doing here. He's holding on. He's rehearsing. Well, let me see if I can give us three takeaways real quick from just some of these observations about David. First of all, one of the things that hits me as I look at David's life is that God is more real to those who need him. He's just more real to people who need him. And as you look at all the ways that David described his life, the pit of destruction, stuck in the mud, people who hate him, people who want to injure him, his own guilt and shame, the hypocrisy from his proclamation versus his behavior, his feeling of being blind and his heart failing, and he's afflicted and he's needy. He's a needy person. That's not something that really sits well with most of us, is it? You know? How many times do you want to meet somebody in an elevator and you say, hey, how you doing? And they I'm just really needy. Can you give me a hug? We're like going, okay, I'll wait for the next one. You know? There's something really unattractive about being needy, isn't there? And yet somehow it's the needy people who really see God. They really experience God. And maybe what we need is more honesty in our life about what's going on, about how frail we are, how we don't really have it all together, how we really don't have control, that we don't have all the answers, that we really do need him to come through for us. Are you aware of that today? Are you still trying to make it look good? Are you still trying to be someone who's got it all together? Do people know where you're hurting? Or do they just see you as, yeah, they're nice and they're happy and everything's okay and they're not like me. They don't suffer like me. They don't have fears like me. They don't have worries like me. But there's something about when we're in community with other people who are needy people, that there's a bonding that takes place. There's a view of God. There's an experience of God that is so rich and so real. And that's a David experience. Secondly, is that our view of God affects our response to him. Our view of him affects our response to him. To me, the most amazing line from this entire song is the second part, where it says that he inclined his ear to me and heard my cry. 9 times David uses the name Yahweh in this psalm, the name of God who created the universe from nothing, who called out and had a relationship with Adam and Eve and Abraham and Jacob and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Moses, who rescued the Israelites from the Egyptians, who set up all the details of the tabernacle, who led them through the wilderness, who brought them into the promised. This is the God he's talking to. And this God leans in when he prays. He leans in. That's who this God is. And as David understands more deeply who this God is, he says, I can trust you. I can come to you. I can lean on you. Why? Because I know who you are. I see that you're big, that you'll take care of me. You really will. You really will. You really have the power and the insight to take care of me. So our vision, our view of God affects our response. And the last thing that I take away from this is the idea that we need to say thank you and help me more often. There's something about saying thank you that makes God bigger in our life, doesn't it? Because we realize it's not about us. That every single thing that we get is a gift from him. And when we say thank you, we make him bigger. And we make him bigger in our life. It wasn't that I was just lucky or clever. It said, no, I'm experiencing the grace and the mercy and the kindness of God. And he just becomes bigger when we do that. And when we look at struggles, no matter what they are, we say, God, help me. Will you help me? I need you. This is so silly, but there are times I've caught myself. This is really silly, but this is just me. It's just like, I'm out looking for something. I'm trying to find my keys. I lose my keys all the time. And what's interesting is I never stop and just say, God, will you help me calm down? Why? Because I can figure it out. I don't need him. Do I need him in simple things like that? Yes. Do I practice this idea that, God, I need your help? Because when I say that, he shows up. He's real. He's real to me. It's not just all up to me. He can help me on the smallest of things and the biggest of things. And that's exactly what this idea of what Christ has done for us is that he's the one that's fulfilled the law. He's the one that's the sacrifice. He's the reason why we can come to him and say, thank you. We have something so incredible to be thankful for. How David said this idea that those who love your salvation, let them continually say, the Lord be magnified. So as you think about what's going on in your life today, how do you demonstrate to God that you're needy? What is your view of God like? Can he handle this corona thing? Yeah, I think he can. Can he help you with your fears and your unknowns about it? Yeah, he can. And during this process, can we say thank you that he's in control? And when we're afraid, can we say, help me, not be afraid? Can he give us that perspective? Yes, he can. Because David helped us understand, David was this example to us about what does it look like to really believe and follow God. Let's pray. Oh, our Father, we are so grateful that you are so real, that there are just countless ways that we can see your beauty and your power and your kindness and your majesty and your beauty, and the list goes on and on and on. You are incomparable. The whole earth is filled with your glory. Thank you so much that you have brought us into your kingdom because what Jesus has done, that he's fulfilled the law, that he's finished the sacrificial system by being the one and only sacrifice that's pleasing to you forever. Will you help us to live honestly before you? Will you help us to see you more clearly? And will you help us practically make you bigger in our life by just saying thank you for the things you've done and given us? And when we're struggling, that we'd say help. And by doing that, would you just become more real to us and more, just alive in our lives and our hearts each day. In Jesus' name, amen.